Ladies and gentlemen, can I please have your attention? And I need all of you to stop what you're doing and listen.
This is Radio Influence. The future is now. This is the Valor Hour, powered by the law offices of Ogle, Elrod, and Beryl on Radio Influence. Your weekly glimpse inside all things Valor Fights, and a look at what's going on in the rest of the MMA community. Here are your hosts, the president of Valor Fights, Tim Loy, and your color commentator, Casey Oxendine.
Welcome to the Valor Hour, a look into everything Valor Fights, as well as headlines from combat sports across the world. Thanks for joining us, and remember to subscribe on Apple Podcasts as well as Stitcher. A huge thanks to our tremendous sponsor, Ogle, Elrod, and Beryl, for supporting our cause each and every week. This week, we recap last week's UFC Fight Night, Machida versus Anders. We discuss a big weekend of UMAF Nationals, and speak with Invicta matchmaker Caitlin Young. As always, Valor Fights President Tim Loy will address your questions during the Valor Hour Q&A segment. I'm Casey Oxendine, and I am joined by the president of Valor Fights, Tim Loy. Tim, we are literally all over the globe this week with fight news from every level and genre of fighting.
Yeah, man, we're diving down into it. You know, last few episodes have been a lot of fun. I kind of like this new format we're doing here. So, lots to talk about.
Well, it's just not you and I here. We're joined by our guest host for this episode, the panel, if you will. Starting off with Mark Laws. How are you doing tonight?
I'm doing great, Casey. How are y'all doing?
Good, man. I've not seen you in a little while. You've been off a couple of weeks, man. Good to have you back. We're also joined by the coordinator, Jeff Hobbs. Jeff, how are you tonight?
What's up, guys? Glad to be here. Glad Mark's back from whatever sabbatical he's been on. Ready to rock and roll tonight.
All right. Of course, we are also joined by Roy Sander. This is a guy that's been a professional mixed martial arts fighter, a promoter, you name it. He's done it in the business. Roy, how are you tonight?
I'm doing great. It's really good to be back on here with you guys.
All right. And of course, we are also joined by the usual suspect, Sawyer Rich. But let's go ahead and get on into the news. Last week, it was UFC Fight Night 125, Machida versus Anders. And that had a lot of bearing here on our area because of Eric Anders. Eric Anders is a Valor Fights veteran, a guy that we hold a lot of respect for. And aside from his work with the University of Alabama, you know, he was a star there. He has really gone on to do big things in mixed martial arts. He faced Lyoto Machida in the main event last weekend, and it was very, very close. He drops the split decision, but man, what a fight, Tim.
Yeah, man, it was I really didn't think that fight would go five rounds, and I really thought that Eric would just kind of overpower him and put it on him and knock him out, you know. And Machida kind of had that spring in his step of old, you know. He was moving and he didn't gas, and he kept on his bicycle for all the rounds. And you know, he made Eric he showed some of the holes, I guess, in Eric's game. But I honestly still thought Eric did enough to win. You know, I thought he landed the more telling shots, the harder blows. Didn't really seem like beyond like leg kicks and things like that Machida was really landing a whole lot. But you know, I thought he won. I bet on him. I was already counting my money, man. And they said it was a split decision the other way. Once they started reading scores the other way, I knew it was probably done.
You know, you and I were talking about it. We were texting back and forth as it was going on, and I was like, man, I just feel like that Anders is going to catch him with one of those. You know, he kept coming forward. When he would come forward, Machida would slip out of the way barely, or he'd catch a big shot. Jeff, I'm sure you watched with anticipation. What do you think about Eric Anders and what is next for him?
Yeah, I'm not so much sold. I kept hearing, you know, the commentators, Machida's back, the Dragon's back, the old Machida, but I really didn't see it that way. Like Tim was saying, other than the leg kicks, man, I wasn't really impressed with what Lyoto did that night. I think what could have changed the fight, I wish Eric would have thrown more jabs and used the jab more. And it just felt like he was waiting for that one punch. I agree with you. I kept waiting for one good solid punch to connect and end the fight. The only problem was that's all he was waiting for was one good solid punch instead of really working a jab and using combinations. But I'm just like Tim, though. I thought he did enough to win the fight. He continued the pressure, kept coming forward. I think he had the more he inflicted the more damage on his opponent. You know, the huge knee that split Machida open was I don't, you know, it was bad. The knee was bad, and I think the cut was in a bad spot too. I was surprised at one point that they didn't stop the fight to take a look at it, just where it was placed and how it was running. And I do believe, I remember at some point in the fight, you know, he spent a lot of time trying to wipe it out of the corner of his eye where you could see what was going in the corner of his eye. I thought Eric did enough to win the fight. I thought he was maybe giving Machida, you know, if it doesn't sound stupid, too much respect, but I think he was just being cautious. He knew this was his first main event, his 5-round fight with a legend, and he didn't want to gas out and be embarrassed on TV. He didn't want to get caught with something and lose the fight. He took it slow. He knew he had 5 rounds, but I think he was just playing it too safe.
Yeah, I agree with you, and I think it could be, like you said, with Machida being the legend that he has, I'm sure Eric Anders is, you know, grown up sort of watching the UFC and seeing Lyoto Machida. Also in the environment, man, being there in Brazil, that's a tall order there. Now, I was mentioning it to him earlier. I think it'd be kind of interesting to see Eric Anders and Derek Brunson. I know Derek Brunson's a little bit ahead there as far, but he took a pretty tough loss there. These are two guys that, you know, I've been around a whole lot, you know, on the regional scene as well. And, you know, he dropped that fight to Ronaldo Jacare. It kind of would make sense a little bit to see those guys go head to head. Mark, do you think that Eric Anders would be ready to contend with the Derek Brunson?
I think Eric Anders isn't ready to contend with anyone anywhere. You know, he's a physical specimen. I had him winning that fight. Him and Brunson, it does seem like a very logical fight. I would pay to see it. But I just think Eric is ready. He's, you know, he went to Brazil to fight Machida, which obviously was a homegrown picking. You know, that's, you can't, if you're going to beat a Brazilian in Brazil, you got to kill his ass. You know, I mean, I thought he won. I thought he beat him definitively. But then again, he wasn't landing a lot of combos, man. And I think he could have done a lot better with his jab. I think he could have put a lot more punches out there on him and really stunned Machida and hurt him a lot worse than what he had him hurt, which was pretty significant.
Well, it was a big co-main event, and this one probably got a lot more press than the main event for a number of reasons. Valentina Shevchenko defeats Priscila Teixeira, formerly unbeaten star there in Brazil. But that wasn't the story. It was really a one-sided beatdown on the part of Shevchenko, and ultimately she gets the rear naked choke there in round two, but there was the talk with referee Mario Yamasaki, a referee that's been around for a lot of years, very, very solid referee, but he's taking a lot of heat, Tim.
Yeah, you know, that was kind of the talk of the event afterwards, still is kind of, I guess, you know, and, you know, he's taking a lot of heat. Dana White and Rogan have both, you know, gone on the record and faulted him for not stopping it earlier. And at the same time, both fighters and, you know, the people involved, you know, with the actual bout, no one seemed to have a problem with it. You know, every time that he would tell her, you know, you got to move, you got to cover up, she would do something, you know, to try to keep her in the fight. And I bet the over two rounds. So I was hoping she would make it on through that round, but she did not. But at the same time, man, you know, you got to fault the UFC somewhat for just putting a match like that together. I mean, everyone saw that when coming out of the gates, it was going to be a mismatch. The line was -1,000. She was 10-1.
Yeah. And, you know, I was going to say, too, you know, there's a lot of heat on those referees. You know, what's odd is that you never see any heat on the corner men because the corner men have the towel, you know.
Yeah,
so, you know, if she's in trouble, you know, and you really care about that person, you know, the corner man can always throw it in. So, you know, I know that the referee is the man licensed for it. But, man, you know, I think the corner man ought to take a little bit. I'm a corner man, so I can say that, you know.
We'll get a little bit more into
this. I don't think it's allowed in the UFC.
Yeah. Well, let's do this, man. Real quick, Tim, anything else that stands out on this card that of note to you?
No, not really. Prezeris missed weight bad again, so they're going to probably make him go to 170, I'm guessing. But he, you know, he beat Dez Green, you know, not a whole lot else on there that was just stellar. I mean, it was whatever, you know, it wasn't bad. I mean, it was free. It was a great free card. I like it probably better than this card this weekend.
And moving on, It was just announced, due to the pullout of Max Holloway, it will be Brian Ortega taking on Frankie Edgar at UFC 222, which is big. And as well, we've also seen the addition of Cyborg versus Yana Kunitskaya to this card. Tim, talk it out.
Well, man, that was, you know, that fight, the whole event, from what I was reading, was potentially in jeopardy when they lost Max. They're, you know, they didn't pull a Valor and just cancel the whole damn thing, at least. But they ended up really being able to pull off something good still. They'll get my money still. They got Brian Ortega now versus Frankie Edgar's, a non-title fight. But that's a, I like that. I'm a T-City fan for sure. So I still like that fight. And now, of course, now they've added Cyborg back in the mix against Kunitskaya, who will be a good challenge. Still don't think she's going to have enough to get it done, but you know, that's two marquee fights there. They're able to kind of save that pay-per-view.
Well, Sawyer, which one are you looking forward to the most? Edgar Ortega or Cyborg Kunitskaya? What say you?
I mean, I'm a big Frank Edgar fan. I mean, it's just, are the years going to catch up with him? You know, Ortega's a game. He's awesome. It's a great fight, really. I think that, you know, if Edgar fights like he can and like we've seen him fight, I don't know that many people can deal with him unless you're like top elite of that division. His wrestling's good. His boxing's great. His wrestling's just as good as boxing. You know what I mean? I mean, his boxing's, he's very, very well-rounded, and I think that's going to be a great fight. As far as the Cyborg fight, I just don't know. Just like Tim just said, I don't see that her offering anything that you know, can pose a problem. I just think the Cyborg is going to be too much for anyone at this point.
Undoubtedly. With that being said, it is time to move on to our Q&A. It's the Valor Hour Q&A segment where Tim Loy, the president, answers your questions. You, the listener. Are you ready, Tim?
I'm ready.
All right, here we go. First question. Tim, how would you grade your guy, Eric Anders' performance against Lyoto Machida, and who would you like to see him fight next? We kind of dug into this already, but now you're on the spot.
I would grade it as probably a B minus. It wasn't bad, but you know, against a guy of that level, especially when Machida brought it the way, you know, he really came to fight. You know, he didn't phone it in. You have to bring that A-plus game, you know. So, I still think he had a good performance, just obviously not quite that, you know, breakthrough performance I'm sure that everyone was hoping for. I know they just booked Thiago Santos against Dave Branch, but I think Thiago Santos and him would be awesome just because they're both such hitters.
All right. Moving on, question number two. The UFC is on a tear with something like 24 events in 26 weeks. What are your thoughts on that? And is that frequency good for business or even sustainable?
Man, that's a lot of events. It's cool for us. It'll give us lots to talk about and me lots to watch and bet on. But I couldn't imagine trying to keep that pace. But, you know, they're a machine. They're a well-oiled machine. So if anyone can, it's them. As far as good for business or bad for business, you know, in our business here, you know, on a regional level, you can't sustain that. It's oversaturation. So I don't think it's good. But you know, the UFC's level, the way that they'll, I'm not familiar with the geographical spread of these events, but I'm sure they're spread out fine, you know, so, you know, I don't think they have the same worries.
Undoubtedly. And not to boost your ego there, but that's one thing I will say about Valor fights is that, you know, it's very difficult to sustain, you know, multiple events in one region. That's what's so great about Valor is we're jumping all over the place. Nashville, Knoxville, you know, a different city. So it changes things up a little bit. So we may not be doing that many events, but one event a month's pretty doggone good. That being said, question number three. Who do you have in Saturday's UFC 221 co-main, Romero versus Rockhold, and main, Hunt Blades? Any other fights stand out on that card?
No other fights really stand out, honestly. I think I'd say the tie to Advisa guy, he's probably, you know, knocked this dude out. He's fighting. That should be, you know, exciting maybe. But I'm going to go with, I want to say Curtis Blades wrestling will be too much for Hunt, but, you know, Hunt fighting at home like that, he's going to be pumped up. Blades' one loss was to Ngannou, who's, you know, kind of a, just a hitter himself. So I want to say Hunt. In the main event, I'll say that it's really nip and tuck and hard to call the first round or two, but I think Rockhold weathers the storm. Romero gasses in about the fourth, and Rockhold gets him out of there.
Yeah, man, Rockhold is hard to, you know, to pick against him because he is so technically sound. All right, next question. At the next UFC card after 221, Donald Cerrone tries to snap a three-fight win streak. Do you think he gets the job done? If not, what's next for Cerrone? What can the next generation of fighters learn from his willingness to accept fights under less than ideal circumstances? I know it's a lot.
Man, that's a hard one to call because Medeiros is on a roll himself, I think, from what I can gather. From what I remember, he seems like he keeps winning and, like, knocking guys out, and maybe, you know, guys he's not supposed to knock out. So I can't say that he's going to get the job done for sure with any kind of certainty. I think that even if he loses, though, the last part of the question kind of ties in. I mean, that he's built his notoriety and his fan base, and, you know, people love him because of that. He's willing to step up and take fights on short notice and get in these tough brawls, and you know, he goes out on his shield, win or lose. So I don't think it necessarily hurts him as far as what the next generation can learn from him. I mean, it's a perfect example of, you know, being willing to step up and you know, take fights and you know, put yourself out there like he does. You're going to obviously, you know, build your fan base and put yourself in good positions like he has. You know, now I don't know how long it keeps your shelf life, you know, in the long term.
Well, I don't think it hurts your billfold either.
No, exactly.
In fact, I think that he's done very, very well for himself. All right, let's move on. Final question.
Okay.
Have there been any discussions about working with Bellator, NASCAR, Monster Energy again this summer?
You know, I actually talked to Rich just last week, and he's waiting to hear exactly what Monster's wanting to do. But it sounds like most likely they, you know, if they continue on like they did, they were definitely very happy with the way this last circuit went. So, you know, if they do make it out this way, I'm positive we'll definitely be, you know, working together again.
Yeah, for sure. That's going to be spectacular. Well, that does it for another Valor Hour Q&A segment. Remember to send in your questions each and every week. Tim Loy will be happy to answer each of them on our broadcast. All right, and down to some Valor Fights news. Of course, Valor Fights 48 heads to Nashville, Tennessee, and this one's going to be a huge one. And we're ready to announce some dates here. And of course, we've got the man behind the script here, if you will, Jeff Hobbs, the coordinator. You've got some announcements to make here.
Absolutely, Casey. We told you guys last week, you know, as we start closing some of these deals, getting some solid verbals, we're going to use the Valor Hour to announce some of these matchups as we go. Last week, we talked about a pro grappling match between Brian Tidwell and Keith Olsen. We talked possibly about Shannon Goffrey and Emily Prince from KMAA. That one's a done deal now, so it's not just speculation. That's going to happen. We've added a few more this week. We're excited to say with Border Wars going down the way it did, it freed up Chris Ocon. So Chris Ocon is going to be performing at Valor Nashville. Tim, you want to talk about the Ocon fight real quick?
Yeah, man, we got Gerald Colbert coming up, a guy that we have seen on our amateur events back. I want to say he fought on Valor 29, maybe even a little past that, but for sure he fought on Valor 29. Very, very tough guy. He's got well over 20 amateur fights behind him. Now he's a pro, and you know, he's a vertically challenged, if you will, but he is one just kind of ball of muscle and explosiveness. And so and Chris Ocon, you know, a true blue chip talent, a national level prospect. So I'm excited. That'll be an action fight.
Absolutely. I was so excited to get him on the card. We've got a second pro grappling match that I'm really excited about. That is Stephen Haig is going to make the trip to Nashville, and he is going to lock up on the mat with Corey Robeson, Robert Drysdale black belt, yeah. A long stay, a Strike Force veteran. He has got back. He opened up his own gym here in Nashville. He's been teaching over the last couple of years, but he's just gotten back into competing, and he's excited. So it's another grappling match for all the BJJ enthusiasts. I'm pumped about those. Another match that I'm definitely excited for, Charlie Alexander, Sawyer's favorite fighter, Charlie Alexander, is locked and loaded. It's a done deal. Charlie and Lathan Lawson are going to scrap in Nashville. I think that's going to end up being a great fight. Both these guys are in tremendous shape, tough powerhouses. I'm excited about that one.
That one's sick. And you know, they're very similar in a lot of ways. You know, their frame's kind of
similar.
You know, both of them muscled up, strong, aggressive. That one's I guess they are. But both of them perform very well, and you know, like I said, and both of them are really cool guys. You know, they're you know, I'm a fan of both of them inside and outside of the cage. So yeah, definitely a showcase fight to, you know, that we're gonna see there in Nashville.
Sawyer, how you see that one going? Sawyer's gone. Never mind.
He's mad.
Sawyer knew we were going to talk about Charlie, and he did.
Oh, my.
Tim, what else we got? I know Tim's been working on some of the amateur fights while I've been kind of concentrating and close up some of these pro fights.
Yeah.
Tim has done a lot of work on the amateur side.
We've still got a couple more pro fights we'll announce next week, including a really good female fight that Caitlin really will want to keep an eye on. But on the amateur side, you know, last week we already talked about Timmy Eisenbraun and Nick Jewell throwing down for the Thai title. We have another title on the line. Steven Summers, who is another stud out of Nashville at Sith Law, Nashville MMA. He'll be taking on the undefeated teen phenom prodigy from X3, Walter McCord, who's like 9-0, 10-0. I mean, that's going to be fire. And then we're going to have our first 185 champion crowned in a good long while, man. It's been like a year, I think, since we've had a 185 amateur champion. So Bailey Cooper, who is, the amateur, he's a rookie of the year, undefeated, 4-0. He's going to take a big step up in competition and take on Casey Peel for that 185 title. And we'll have some more news next week about some more title fights. We've got a defending champion that's going to throw down. We'll talk about next week, and as well as hopefully we'll get Ava Mai matched as well, getting close to something for him, and lots more. This is stacking up to be a really, really solid card.
Yeah, and remember, it's Valor Fights 48. That's going to be at the Fairgrounds Sports Arena there in Nashville, Tennessee, March 31st. And, of course, last time we were there, man, it was a great time. It was a party. It always is a party there in Music City. They are a huge fighting city. They love Valor Fights there, and we love to be there. So be sure to get your tickets as soon as possible. Get them. If you can't be there, of course, you can watch live on Flow Combat. We've got, again, we anticipate even more as the weeks get closer, and so I'm so excited for it. So we look forward to big things and big announcements coming up soon. That said, it is time to move on to a tremendous interview. We are joined by Caitlin Young, Invicta matchmaker and true legend of the golden era of WMMA. Caitlin, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you for having me.
Hey, we appreciate you coming on, Caitlin, for sure. Big fan of your work with Invicta, obviously showcasing the females of this sport in such a great way. So, you know, tell us a little bit about what y'all have coming up. We have, I know, Invicta 28 coming up. It'll be the first time you all are in Utah, right?
Yes. Yeah. Salt Lake City. It's pretty exciting. I think they have a pretty solid fight community there, so we're really looking forward to it. Deanna Bennett has been a veteran of the Invicta shows on the UFC page, is also fighting on that card, so I think it should be fun for her to fight, you know, near her hometown, and we're really looking forward to it.
Now, Caitlin, it's really cool to have you here. And, you know, and I remember, you know, you were part of the old WMMA scene, the hook and shoot, the Elite XC. You know, you faced competitors like Gina Carano, Misha Tate, Julie Kedzie twice. You know, talk about your time back then and how much different now. You know, Invicta, Shannon Knapp and Invicta has taken this thing to such another level. Yeah, I remember Rose Namajunas seeing her with that flying armbar finish. Now she's the UFC champion. Yeah. You know, it's, you know, talk about it then, talk about it now, and how different it is to you know, from being a competitor to being a matchmaker.
Wow, you know, it's so interesting to think back on that time, because my first professional fight, they weren't even allowing women to fight the same amount of time as men. They'd make you fight 3-minute rounds instead of 5-minute rounds. So it did change the game a little bit. And really the female fights, it was one here or there. And I came in around 2007. But it was just much more few and far between. And the women were paid, even the top level were paid pennies compared to the men. But Invicta really shook things up. I remember first getting the call about it and thinking that it sounded too good to be true, because I'd been hearing rumors and rumblings that there's this new organization coming. But you know, if you've been around MMA for a while, you hear that however often, and then they would tank, like promotions would go under routinely at that time. Elite XC had just gone under how long were they even up and running? A year or two? Something short, right, like that, after they transitioned from Show XC. So it was really incredible, because I think what Shannon did with Invicta was create a platform where women could compete A, regularly, and B, in their proper weight class. I mean, that's the other thing. At that time, nearly everybody was competing at 135 pounds, not that because it was ideal for them. Some of those women have even dropped to 115 now, but because it was really the only option. And now they've been able to sharpen themselves on each other, essentially. And it created the sort of environment where I think probably fighting in America has to be one of the closest pay scales for men and women in professional sports. It has to be. And I think a lot of that is due to what the work that Shannon Knapp and Invicta has done.
So, you know, that first group, I remember, you know, you had your Carla Esparzas and Jessica Penny and Rose, mm-hmm. that we mentioned before, and that went on to do the Ultimate Fighter with Team Rousey and Team Tate. And that really, I think, went to another level. It took the WMMA scene to another level. But Invicta's got a whole new crop of talent, you know. Some of the older competitors you see kind of returning to Invicta, but mm-hmm. then you're seeing a new crop of people that are rising out of that. Talk a little bit about those new stars that are kind of ready to make that breakaway into the next level.
Yeah, that's another really incredible thing that's happened. And I think because young women can see fighting as an actual career path, see MMA as a career path now. They're, when we get them straight out of the amateurs, they look so composed. The level of pro debuts right now is so much higher than it's ever been on the women's side of the game. And that's really incredible. And I think we're going to see, you know, we've already seen it, but I think we're going to continue to see a really big jump in the level of competition coming up here.
Well, we have Jeff Hobbs on here. You know Jeff very well. And yes. Jeff, you've got a few questions for Caitlin.
Absolutely. And it's a pleasure to be on. I'm so excited to be able to put this interview together for us. You know, I deal with Caitlin, you know, on a kind of a manager with Amy. But to be able to just sit and shoot the bull now with her about, like I said, I'm a mark also for the OGs. And, you know, when I first, you know, became, you know, acquainted with Caitlin, we talked about it earlier, was the Gina Carano fight. And was that like 09, 08, I believe?
Yeah, 2008.
And so, you know, my first question and what I want to talk about was something we talked about before you came on air. But going back to that fight was stopped by a doctor stoppage, if I'm not mistaken, right?
Yes. Yes, I was already
yes,
a doctor. Doctor at that
yes, point, exactly, yes. A doctor stoppage. So we had Caitlin, who I'm sure wanted to continue that fight and see it all the way through. This weekend we saw about in the UFC where we had a non-stoppage that was really controversial. But I wanted to ask you, Caitlin, from a promotion slash matchmaker point of view, what was your take on the non-stoppage? And then thinking back to when you were in that fight and you had a bout kind of pulled out from under you and just told you can't fight anymore, what's your take on it from a fighter's, you know, perspective on would you have wanted your fight to be stopped if you were in that same position?
So that's a really great point you bring up. And that's something that has been a really interesting experience for me because there are some times when I have a matchmaking slash promoting viewpoint and a fighter's viewpoint about things. And they don't always agree. So, you know, from a promotion standpoint, you don't want bad press. You don't want things that are going to turn off fans and you don't want unnecessary injury to a fighter.
Mm-hmm.
So you have those things to worry about. But as a fighter, you know, this is a really, you know, you want to go out on your shield. And, you know, I think almost anybody, especially if they've gotten to the UFC level, they're not going to want to fight stops unless it's absolutely necessary. And sometimes they'll be upset at the time and then go back and watch the video and feel different. In this particular case, though, I think something, and this is true of the stoppage in my fight with Gina, I was getting worked. I was losing that fight badly. However, a fight being lost isn't necessarily a reason to step in. Safety of the fighter is the reason to step in. So there's some controversy on whether or not she had tapped to the rear naked choke. We'll talk about that separately. Let's say just the amount of damage having been done in the fight. I don't think she looked that injured. Was she mounting an offense? No, not really. It was a mismatch. But did it look like she was so damaged it was necessary for him to pull Valentina off earlier? I don't think it did. And I think that's something important to keep in mind is they're there for the fighter's safety. I think if we saw a similar fight with two males and that was going that way with the same amount of damage, I don't think there would be as much outrage about it. As much progress as we've made, I don't think it's quite equal as far as public perception of damage just yet.
Right. I saw something interesting earlier. I read Frank Trigg's take on the fight. And he said, well, if this is what we're talking about, then Yamasaki cost me $1 million because he allowed my fight with Matt Hughes to go. You know, I wish he would have stopped that earlier then and not let it go on as long. So
that's a great point. Yeah.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It was a nice take on it. Something else I wanted to ask you while we're on the air is you guys have a new employee, if I'm not mistaken, and that's the UFC Bantamweight champion, Amanda Nunes. Tell us about her position with Invicta.
So she's coming in, you know, she's helping the fight team, and it's really excellent because I don't actually know her very, very well personally, but I've heard nothing but great things about her. And we have a lot of talent coming out of Brazil, which is great. You know, a lot of really tough fighters, really tough new signs we've had recently too, that are showing a ton of promise. But I think what you see sometimes in these countries where there's a language barrier is sometimes it's really easy for the athlete to be taken advantage of. It's not just Brazil. There are other places this happens. Thailand is the same way. When we sign a fighter, we, you know, expect that they are being told the exact terms of the contract, et cetera. But sometimes it doesn't happen. So it's so beneficial for us to not only have somebody on staff who speaks fluent Portuguese, but also somebody who I think has, you know, the best interest of the fighters at heart. You know, Amanda is in an amazing position. She doesn't need to use these fighters to leverage something for herself. But that's not always the case with managers. So it's really nice to be able to say somebody contacts us saying that they're the new manager for a girl, be able to reach out and say, is this correct? Is this your manager? Things like that, that are really difficult to do if you don't speak Portuguese. So it's really awesome to have her on staff. She really wants to help, and she's been having nothing but great interactions with the athletes so far.
Awesome, awesome. Well, it's great to see her on board. My last question, Caitlin, is when we talk about you being one of the originals, that you've been doing this for so long, people are under the impression that you might be a little old, but I'm here to tell them you're not. And I see all the time because I follow you, you still compete. You are only 32 years young and you still compete
right.
in Muay Thai. What do you have coming up? Do you have anything coming up?
I do, actually. I'm fighting in Minnesota. We've really been kind of getting the ball rolling here with Muay Thai. So now we have standalone shows. Initially, we were doing them mixed with the MMA show because it takes a little while to build up your fan base so the show can support itself and stand alone. But I have a big title defense for the 142-pound TBA world title on May 12th here in Minnesota.
Well, we're going to be watching. I'm definitely going to be rooting.
And it'll be on Full Combat, I believe.
Oh, nice.
Will it? All right. We will check
Caitlin,
in.
Caitlin, real quick, this is normally when I ask the fighters to give shout-outs where they're due and to give me their social media plugs and stuff like that. And I was going to say, you know, well, since you're representing Invicta, go ahead and give those social media plugs. Now that I hear you're still competing, I'm going to go ahead and throw it to you all the way around. You know, throw out your social media plugs, where we can find you and follow you as the fighter, Caitlin Young. And then also all of the plugs for Invicta. Of course, with Invicta 28 coming up, we want to know where we can watch it. Of course, it's UFC Fight Pass, but, you know, all the times and everything and so forth.
Yeah, so it is going to be March 24th will be the next Invicta show. It's going to be great in Salt Lake City. You know, and always, really everything there is a team effort. And we have such a small staff, but a wonderful staff. And they really, you know, care a lot about their work and the athletes and it makes for a wonderful promotion. I think Shannon has done an amazing job with that. And then also, I'll talk about my sponsors for a second. Menacing Valor, MMA Roadhog, Mr. Mouthguard have all been absolutely wonderful in supporting me in my crazy Thai boxing adventures, which sometimes take me out of the country to odd places, but it's been absolutely wonderful having their support. And I'm on Twitter at @Caitlin_Young and Instagram at @CaitlinYoungify.
All right. Invicta matchmaker Caitlin Young continues her journey in mixed martial arts and beyond. Be sure to check out Invicta 28 live on UFC Fight Pass March 24th. Caitlin, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That does it for a great interview, but we aren't through yet. It is time for this week's Valor Hour main event. Tonight, we discuss the landscape of amateur MMA sanctioning body UMAF, that's United States Mixed Martial Arts Federation. In addition to their big three-day national tournament last weekend, UMAF made history this week as they were approved as an official amateur sanctioning body in the state of South Carolina. And we are joined, in addition to our panel, we are joined by UMAF Southeast Director Justin Brown. Justin, how are you doing tonight?
I'm good, buddy. Thanks for having me on. Always good to be here.
So it was a big deal, man. Of course, UMAF, just like we were part of it last year, this year, you know, we saw a few changes, but it was three days of fighting. Justin, kind of break it down for us a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's still 3 days. We backed it up to be Thursday, Friday, and Saturday because it ended up kind of coinciding with Super Bowl Sunday, which we didn't realize until after that was already planned. So instead of being a Friday, Saturday, Sunday, like we did in previous years, we backed it up to be Thursday, Friday, Saturday. Worked out great. The fights were awesome. This year we introduced a novice tournament in addition to the open brackets, which competed or were able to earn a spot on the U.S. team. So that was something new we did this year. Was received very well and actually helped us fill in a lot of gaps to make some full fight cards, which was awesome. And as you know, I think you saw on Saturday, the day of the finals, we introduced the youth national championships through USFL during our UMAF adult national championships, and that was received extremely well. They brought in some pretty big crowds, and those kids can bang. Those kids get it. It's fun to watch.
Undoubtedly. So, of course, it great opportunities for a lot of your amateur competitors. There are lots of good things. There are some challenges too, you know, and we saw that, you and I discussed it a little bit, as far as, you know, some of those last minute fallouts. You know, some of the brackets weren't as full as one would expect, you know, and that happens. And I think it could come from the idea that, you know, the competitors, you know, have, they're coming from all over. It's difficult sometimes to get the sponsorship to get out there. Tim, what is your take on the UMAF tournament, and you know what is good and what could be improved upon?
I absolutely love the concept. I really do. It kind of gives amateurs kind of more of a structured, tiered, organized system to kind of, you know, work through as an amateur, beyond just, you know, taking random fights and hoping to get some belts and things like that, you know. And there's lots of amateurs that, you know, that may be the, it may be the culmination of what they, you know, what they're aiming for out of MMA is, you know, a national championship or a world championship. And then for guys that, you know, their destination is to be a pro. I mean, I can't imagine, you know, something that could prepare you better than the international competition and seeing the different looks and, you know, competing multiple days, making weight multiple days, just the discipline involved to do such. So as far as the concept of it, I love it. And I've always just been like in a nerd kind of way. I just like it. I like tournaments, you know, and I like that setup. It's, it's interesting to me. So, you know, I love the concept. The one thing though, as has been evident, you know, as in the past couple of years, is just filling out these brackets and making it a true, indication of, you know, doing the very best we can to get the top representative in each weight class for Team USA. Because I mean, man, I could only imagine like the possibilities, you know, when you really think about what you could put together, you know, to send to international competition. And it's really exciting to think about that, you know. And watching, you know, I watched the Worlds, the stream of the Worlds, and that was really awesome. You know, that was a really awesome setup and just a, you know, really badass experience. You could tell that everyone that went over there just really loved it. And, it was like an eye opener as to, you know, the kind of competition that's out there and the different, you know, customs and whatnot. So, you know, I love that part of it. It's just kind of figuring out, you know, what can we do to have the maximum amount of participation that we can get out of everyone, and for everyone to feel like they have a good shot at making this Team USA, which I feel like is, you know, a huge honor, you know, to get to do, especially as UMAF and IMAF works towards making, you know, MMA an Olympic sport. You know, this is kind of the ground level of that. It's not a perfect science to it. So everything's so young, it's all kind of trial and error, obviously. But one thing I just see that's just not working is kind of putting all the eggs into one basket for like one big event. And we really, you know, everybody says they're coming, but then they don't come. And you're just kind of like left with, you know, what you have. And so I think personally, it would maybe be better served to really coordinate and organize even more so, like hard on the regional level, to where each region, you know, if you split it into four regions or so, each region essentially generates like one top guy in each weight class. And that way we're not, you know, reaching out to the first eight Jamokes that sign up and say they're going to do this. And, you know, and man, you know, let's face it, these are amateur fighters. And, you know, if there's anything an amateur likes to do, it's a lot of the time, not saying that it's about everyone, but, you know, we see it all the time, is, you know, to put it out there in social media that they're doing this national championship and get all this rally of support behind them and get everybody talking about it. And then when it comes time to go out there and fight for 3 days and make weight for 3 days, they don't want to do that shit, you know? So yeah. I feel like if you really streamline it on the regional circuit and And, you know, each region is really developing like one guy to kind of go and represent that region in the final. You knock it down to a 2-day thing instead of a 3-day thing. You're only sending four people, so you're only counting on four mofos to show up. And you know this, you know, and you can plan as such. And at that point, you know, each region's guy, I would think, would have shown enough reliability and enough, has shown that they want this enough to see it through, you know, and actually go and not leave everyone hanging, if that makes sense.
Yeah, they also wouldn't have to make wait 3 days. They would make wait 2 days.
Right. And the disadvantage of course, I know is not the simulation of doing it multiple days at IMF. And I get that, but yeah. I think we could get a better team and we could put and have just a real and really just a, I mean, I want to see us have a badass team.
Yeah. Justin, let me ask you this. And this is something I've thought, and it's really not going to pertain as much to UMAF as it does to IMAF, but you're over there. You see it a whole lot. To me, what I see as a challenge for getting, you know, continuing to get more and more of the top level amateurs, and we're talking about when you get Jackson's involved and get Rufus Sports and, you know, and American Top Team, and they're sending their best, and, they, you know, like it turning into – and then looking into going into the Olympics, I see that the weight issue it might be the hindrance. Like, in other words, with people concerned about making weight for professional fighters, we talked about it forever last week. When you're talking about having amateurs make weight 3 days and, you know, emaciating themselves, you know, they're dry as a bone that day of the fight, and then they have to go and fight that night. The science of that, you know, is can be dangerous. You know, there could be implications. I'm not a scientist, but I'm saying that some people could consider that. Do you think, I thought, what if, you know, if there was a weigh-in segment and then you weigh in the next time, but you just don't put on so much weight. So in other words, that way you're not weighing in and actually cutting weight each and every time. That's just something that kind of came to my mind, and I've been, you know, different people have spoken with me about it. And those are the kind of concerns that I've heard. What is your thought, Justin?
Sure. You know, I'd love to say that weight cutting is our biggest problem, that people don't show up or don't participate, but it's truly not. But what we have discussed is implementing a 4-point weight system, not kind of emulating similar to what Andy Foster has rolled out for his 10-point system in California, only allowing you a certain amount of weight. But what we have to do is we have to follow the format of other Olympic sports, and other Olympic sports have that mandatory weight requirements of all days. So if you go into USA boxing, or you go into Taekwondo, or you go into any other weight required sport, you can't be the 145-pound champion if you're not 145 pounds. So we're almost relegated to follow that same format once we get to the international level. So for us at UMAF, we can implement however we want, but that's not really allowing them a proper practice run for when they do get up to the international level and it's more days. So, you know, it's something we're talking about, and we definitely want to try to corral that in. Luckily, we haven't had any super dangerous, no injuries involved around weight cuts, and we really hardly have anybody that's missing weight. Because the educational coach, knowing that most people are fighting up one weight class, we do have some people trying to cut weight multiple days in their standard fighting weight class, but the bulk of people we see actually moving up one weight class when they know they have to fight multiple days in a row. In fact, almost everybody on our team that went to Worlds fought up one weight class from their normal. So that, you know, they're getting educated about it. They understand it. We got to get more educated about it and what we can allow. We have a neurosurgeon who sits on our board, Dr. Wang, who works with the U.S. Olympic Committee and travels all around with different sports. And he's very, very forward-thinking as far as educating athletes and the dangers of weight cuts involving specifically to combative sports, because you're lowering that amount of liquid around your brain. And when you do wrestling, heavy weight cuts, it's not as dangerous as when you're taking, you know, actual blows or damage to the head with that low fluid level. So it's a, you know, it's vastly different and very dangerous. So that's something that we're very aware of, and we're keeping caution of and continuing to educate ourselves and passing that education on to our athletes and coaches as we have it. But yeah, it's being worked on. It's definitely not a perfect science, and hopefully we can change it up.
Yeah, undoubtedly. Roy, we've not talked to you much tonight. What is your take? You know, you were there around the UMAF Nationals last year. What is your take on the UMAF you know, scene, and as far as the IMAF, the Worlds, what is your take on that opportunity for amateur competitors?
I think both of those are the pinnacle for amateurs. I mean, we've discussed a lot of things about it, you know, leading to the Olympics, you know, because a lot of amateurs, you know, they just fight and really, I mean, aside for personal accolade or, you know, receiving some likes on, you know, Twitter or Facebook, you know, there's not a lot of reward. So, you know, if you can go out there and represent the USA on a national, on an international format, I mean, that's amazing. And that should be like the top goal for all amateurs, you know, before going pro. I mean, you know, you're ready to go pro if you can go to the IMAF and, you know, actually be successful. So I think it's great in that regard. I think the weight cutting, you know, and the weight was the big issue. And like he just said, you know, the fighters fighting up a weight class, I mean, that's kind of a given. I think if you've got to make the weight those multiple days. So, you know, it's a little different than what fighters will experience once they get to the UFC and they're fighting down and cutting weight. But still, I mean, it boils down to how much skill you have and how much time you put in and how much you've improved. And, you know, if you can fight a weight class up, then that's just more indication that you're ready, you know, when you come back and just get back on the pro scene or even back on the amateur scene. I would like to see all sanctions. I wish there could be a universal sanctioning body for everywhere. I think that would help filter in the best talent, you know, in the same tournament. I mean, unless you could somehow work it out with, you know, there's so many. I know in Virginia there's three different, well, four counting UMAF now, sanctioning bodies, you know, in Virginia. And you've got a lot of different fighters that fight for each sanctioning body. You know, some fighters are stingy and only fight for one sanctioning body, or their coaches will only allow them to fight for one sanctioning body.
Even
that's just
most
really
of
silly.
Them.
Most
yeah, the, there are events that will sanction with two or three different sanctioning bodies, you know, and, yeah. And so you sometimes you never know, but you're absolutely right. Now, one thing that I was very tickled about and so excited about in all of this was what I mentioned at the onset of this, that the UMAF was just approved in the state of South Carolina. I know it's a little off topic, but it's definitely a major deal that UMAF gets approved as an official sanctioning body in the state of South Carolina. So, you know, whereas before, you know, you would be sanctioning with, you know, a full lineup of inspectors and so forth, whether it was a pro-am or an all-pro event or an all-amateur event, you would still have to undergo that, you know, excess level of sanctioning and so forth. With UMAF taking over the amateurs there, this is huge. And, you know, I think that as far as seeing a lot more amateur events moving into the state of South Carolina, I think it's going to be a very big deal. I spoke on behalf of UMAF there, but no one has done more for UMAF in the state of South Carolina than Justin. Justin, what is your take on all this?
I really appreciate you noticing that. It's been a long, long road. As you noticed, it was 2.5-year battle with the state. The state had originally, when MMA was legal in South Carolina, it's been almost 8 years ago now, there was multiple sanctioning bodies and the state shut it down. So the state statutes require the South Carolina Athletic Commission took over professional and amateur sports. And there's been no other sanctioning bodies allowed since then. I believe the last one was about 8 years ago with ISKA. So the state statutes had kind of locked it all out. Well, there's an interpretation in there that does allow for third-party sanctioning under certain conditions, and we got that interpreted in a way that would allow us to be able to sanction within the state of South Carolina. So, you know, whenever a state law is in place or whenever a state statute is written, it's almost impossible to change those state statutes because it's got to go before the state government and general counsel. And it's got to be approved and put back in as a bill just to amend it, and it's just not an easy process, which takes many, many years, as you know. So once the state decides to make it law, it's hard to change. So that was a long battle, but with the support of the Athletic Commission, who was very supportive of what we're trying to accomplish nationally and internationally, they really pushed for us as well, and it got interpreted in a manner that allows us to now sanction all amateur shows. When it's a pro-am mixed show, that the state will still have to sanction those, but any full amateur events will be allowed to sanction in South Carolina.
I'll tell you what, Will McCullough is outstanding. He is exactly what that state needed to move to the next level. He, you know, he really, you know, he says it, man. You know, he said the best regulation is minimal regulation, making sure everything is straight up and done safely and so forth. But, you know, but get these fights happening, get the sport growing. And I really, really am so impressed with what he's done so far. He's very logical. He's not egotistical, which is rare. prayer for someone that is in that position, can be. So that is really a shout out. Now, Jeff, you've worked with your part in Valor Fights with the UMAF for quite a time, you know, bit of time. How do you feel about the UMAF as opposed to a standard state regulating body overseeing the fights?
Well, you know, when it comes to fight night, you know, there's really no difference. You know, that all the work's usually been done by then. You know, I've spent my time as an ISK rep for the state of Tennessee. You know, so I've spent years working with them, and I still do that occasionally. But, you know, I'm really impressed with, it seems like the ISKA over the years has been just complacent as far as, you know, this is who we are. We've got this recognition, name recognition, and we're okay with our place in the sport, you know. But UMAF is trying to grow, you know. Let's see where else we can take it. Let's take it further. Let's see how far we can take this. And that's been refreshing. You know, the format we've been talking about with the tournaments, you know, I was there and I was a part of the one in East Tennessee last year. And just like I think we've already spoke about, you know, the fights that took place, no disappointment at all. You know, the disappointment that I felt was more when you look around at everybody that's there and you know all the hard work that went in, that everybody put in, and it just didn't show through. You know, the fights were great. The fights that we had and that we saw were great. But, you know, no crowd, you know, things like that. And kind of like what Tim talked about it, I thought, you know, aren't we doing this more as in a promotion thing, you know? You've still got, I don't know, Justin, you tell me, how many states are you guys in right now? Or I wouldn't say how many states. What are your bigger states? What are the states that you have the most promoters using UMAF?
We do a good bit in Missouri where we're founded at, kickboxing and uh-huh. MMA. We do a lot in Nevada, all through upper north and into Las Vegas. We do a pretty good bit there. We've right. got some other stuff in the Pacific Northwest that we're taking over. Washington State we're licensed in. Clearly, we do Tennessee. We probably do a lot of stuff in Tennessee. They're one of our biggest states because Valor is so active. And with Valor, we've taken on a lot of other things that are, I guess, subsidiaries or partners or whatnot with Valor, D3 and several others. So we've been successful there. We do work in Virginia. We do work in Florida. Georgia, we're sanctioning in, doing stuff in all over. Michigan, we just took over one of the big shows up there. So we're operating in 14 states currently.
Right, right. Well, and where I was going with that was my thoughts were was taking a few of your states that are the biggest contributors and partners with UMAF, the ones that are giving you the most shows per year, and kind of like what you did with Valor last year, going into that show, but letting those promotions, you know, come up with their best 170, their best 185s, where it almost would feel like a promotion versus promotion, and maybe it was. But not necessarily having a tournament or fight-in matches to find, you know, but just plain old, you know, Tim Loy from Valor Fights from the state of Tennessee saying my best 170 is this guy. And, you know, one of your top promotions in Missouri that's constantly, you know, putting on shows saying, you know what, well, our best 170 is this guy. And letting those matches happen like that, you know, kind of a promotion versus promotion, but the states that are huge UMAF contributors, you know, coming up with their fighters and then having those because, you know, and then the fights could happen at the promotions, which at that point your crowd's going to come. Cause that was one of the other things, you know, you could hear during that is, you know, these guys that are just signing up online and coming in from Alabama or Georgia or Florida, that's great that you're getting fighters from that far out, but they're not bringing anybody, you know, they're not going to bring anybody to, you know, that high school in Knoxville or I can't even remember what city we were in, but, you know, maybe your crowd participation would be but maybe your crowd participation would be more, the ticket sales would be there. You know, they're just things that I've thought about. But you know, all in all,
I think also something that would you know, if it were to be able to be coordinated, getting, you know, when you do win, you know, I felt like that, you know, last year there were some guys that were really disappointed once they realized the amount of expense it was going to take to get them over to Bahrain. And so, oh, yeah. You know, really working and organizing a way to in which all of the winners, the competitors are able to be subsidized somehow, because that is a big thing. You know, when all these Olympic athletes go to the Olympics, you know, they are paid for and then some, you know, and I think that some competitors, it's hard for them to get that money together. And I think, you know, a lot of them had to bow out. I mean, I know Billy Swanson did. I know Billy was at first really, really excited about it, but he had to bow out because it was a lot of expense and so forth. And there were a number of others, and then others, you know, stepped up, you know, they were able to step in there. You know, so, I mean, you know, to go right along with it, you know, finding a way that when you do win and you that way you get, you know, that juice for the squeeze, if you will.
I agree with you. And I think nobody knows that more than our board of what our limitations are and what we're trying to accomplish. And it's almost, it's really, really tough pill to swallow. Laying our cards on the table, you know, the amount of money it takes to even implement the legals and everything else to start the program, it was almost a six-figure loss for UMAP, being $100,000 or more in debt. And every year we've made that up. And I think to the point now where we're 20-something thousand dollars in debt, without getting into the specifics and boring everybody, but we're probably two years off from being fully self-sustainable, where we can put money back into the full platform. And that's with nobody taking a penny. There's even Ryan, who works with UMAP, he doesn't receive a single penny in pay. It all goes to pay back our debt and our overhead every single year. So we're getting to the point where that's coming. I mean, we meet with blue chip sponsors every year. I met with several, Ryan, Frank, everybody, but it's a really tough pill to swallow that those guys don't want to invest in amateur adult sports. A lot of people want to back up the youth side. A lot of people want to back up the professional side. But when adults decide that they want to compete in a cage as amateurs, it's more like a training program for them. And we're having a problem getting them, the large blue chip sponsors, on board for that. And maybe that's our limitations, that we can't do it yet. But it's been a struggle trying to get those sponsors. And a lot of the other sports that you discussed, once they're part of a national governing body under the United States Olympic Committee, the funding is wide open for those teams. And we see it in other countries. Our sister federations or our partner federations throughout the world, throughout IMAF, are massive, because they're the only recognized body within their states or within their nation. So, for example, Romania and these other ones, that they're the only body, their national team trials are sold out. It's a 3-day televised event, blue chip sponsors everywhere. And that's how serious these other nations take it. And that's the large group of them. The U.S. has been very, very hard for us to organize that properly and to get the recognition here. But we want to emulate what USA's boxing is doing, just like you guys said earlier and Tim mentioned. We want to have the proper regions, but there's a lot of regions we can hardly touch. The Northeast, we really don't even have anybody yet. Michigan and Virginia are the closest, but we've got to have those states that allow us to operate within there, or we're really just cherry picking two states in a region. And we want to make it a true regional. I'd love to have more people from Louisiana involved, Alabama, Mississippi, those states. They've got some great fighters that come out of Texas and Louisiana, I can tell you. So we'd love to be able to do that program. And we're learning as we go as well. It's on its way, but, you know, we're going to continue to grow, and we will get those sponsors and we will get funding, but it's just taking time.
Well, I'll tell you what, we know that it's not from lack of effort, and you're really fielding these questions very, very well, man. And, you know, like, I agree with you. I understand completely, you know, you can't get blood out of a turnip, you know, and, you know, it's very, very challenging. Since we have you here, you know, another topic that we were going to discuss tonight, and with you being on the regulatory side, we wanted to get your input as well on this. Of course, we saw last weekend at UFC Fight Night 125 in the co-main event, Valentina Shevchenko versus Priscilla Cachera. And Mario Yamasaki is the referee overseeing the event. Some felt that in addition to the fight possibly being a mismatch, that Yamasaki allowed the fight to go on too long. There was too much of a beating there. Eventually, Shevchenko did finish by rear naked choke 4 minutes, 25 seconds into round two, but not before a tremendous beating. So real quick, I'm going to go ahead and send it to Sawyer. Sawyer, I know you watched the fight. We've not heard from you on the topics yet. What was your take on that?
I mean, what do you say? I mean, Yamasaki, I feel like that you should be able to expect more. I feel like that he knew that maybe it should have been stopped multiple times. I mean, she took a beating. I think the the strike, actually the nets or whatever, was 230 strikes to three, I read. I think that's accurate. You know, correct me if I'm wrong, but I mean, that's just insane. And I read on the internet afterward, you know, because I looked into this. I mean, he got bashed over that. We're not stopping it. And, you know, he said that he gave her a chance to be a warrior, which, you know, how much warrior are you being when you're taking a beating like that? I understand it's co-main. It's a big deal, and she's on a big stage. But, you know, even Dana White said that he shouldn't even sit back into the octagon. I mean, it's very controversial. I feel it should have been stopped before it was. I don't really know what to say because it is what it is. I mean, we've seen controversy over and over again in MMA, but I feel like this one definitely could have been avoided.
Yeah, you know, Mario Yamasaki was the first guy in combat sports, first person I ever met. I used to take guys up to the Mario Yamasaki grappling tournament that was up in Woodbridge, Virginia, and it was really the first experience I ever had in grappling tournaments and so forth, this mid-90s. And he was, you know, had just gotten the job there with the UFC then, so he's been at it for a long time. We're looking at about 25 years almost. Gosh, that's a long time. Mark, you're one that you're a cut man and you're an enthusiast of excessive violence, but was this too much?
Absolutely, man. No questions asked. That, like, yes, it was a mismatch from the get-go. Everybody saw it coming in. However, you can't let a girl lay there and take 230 blows to the head where three that she gets. And then to say stupid shit like, oh, I just wanted to let her be a warrior. No, you're letting her get her head bashed in. That's all you're doing. And listen, I'm not one to criticize referees. That's the hardest job in the game by far. But over and over again, I see Mario in shitty positions and just not being, you know, cage IQ. You know, he's just not aware of what's going on in the whole situation. It's frustrating to me from somebody who, like, I try to read all the feelings of these fighters, you know, and see where they're at. And it just doesn't feel like the same effort's going in. It's frustrating to see somebody lay there and take an ass beating like that. And it should have been stopped long before that.
Tim, what say you on the matter?
Well, I have a hard time, like, disagreeing with the guys and saying that it couldn't have been stopped before. But like I said earlier, you know, every time he was talking to her, he would say that, you know, he would ask for her to move, ask for her to defend herself. And every time he would kind of warn her, like he's about to stop, like she would do something, you know, and however little it may be. I mean, there was like a noticeable, you know, effort. Again, I will disclose, I was cheering for this fight to make it to a third round because I put money that it would last two rounds. So I'm essentially like, you know, like, she's moving still, don't stop it. So I've got to disclose that at the time I was like hoping that he wouldn't stop it, and that's foul. I know I hate to even admit that, but that's the truth. And so I don't know. I mean, he has that, you know, Yamasaki, that's kind of, you know, he lets fights go. I mean, he's known to let things go like that. And you know, there's no criticism of the matchmaking of UFC for putting this fight together. You know, when, like, I mean, I think, you know, you wrote or like read any of the previews and stuff leading up to it, everyone just said murder, essentially, that this wasn't a competitive fight for a girl making her debut in the UFC. On paper, it looked okay.
8-0, you know, it's kind of hard, you know, to argue that it's that bad. I mean, if she's an undefeated prospect at 8-0, you know.
Sure, I think it's just that Chico's been in there with elite competition,
right,
fighting
exactly
for world titles at a higher weight class.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and I, you know, like, Justin, you know, it's very touchy subject there. You know, you run into, you know, you have to improve your position. You have to keep moving. How much damage, you know, of all those shots that she took, how much damage are you getting when you're a grounded opponent? If you're tapping them, at what level does it take it to the next level? And, you know, I was saying this earlier, I'm a corner man. I mean, I know that the referee is commissioned to stop those fights. When does the corner man step in and say enough is enough?
It's actually depending on the state. Some states, the corner man cannot legally stop the fight. Some states you can.
Yep.
Yeah. So legally, it depends where you're at and the governing authority. So the corner man cannot stop a fight in many, many states. Doesn't matter if you throw a towel in or not. The ref's got to throw the towel back out. or call for time and tell the corner to sit down. But more than likely, even if I'm in a state where a cornerman's clearly wanting the fight stopped, I'm probably going to stop the fight. And let me say this. Had he stopped the fight early, he would be getting just as much criticism for saying he didn't allow the fight to continue on. She wasn't truly in danger. She wasn't not intelligently defending herself. She wasn't physically hurt. So a lot of people are going to have the same criticisms about the same call because it, you know, it became touchy. Mario's got a decade plus of great track record of doing great fights. So, you know, this is one that happened to catch a lot of people's eyes. You can look at the statistics after the fight, ex post facto, and say 200-something punches to three. Clearly, it was one-sided, but nothing in the rules and regulations, even trained from the ABC, says that you stop a fight because they're just outclassed or outmatched. It has things that we're trained on to look for when somebody's hurt or not intelligent defending yourself, and she seemingly was doing just enough to continue in the fight. Now, if the ABC is asking officials to now stop fights that are completely outclassed or one-sided, then that needs to be something that's trained, discussed within the ABC, and voted on and approved worldwide, globally, so we can all do the same thing. But had he stopped that fight early, I promise you, we'd still be having the same discussion of why did he stop that fight.
Very true. Undoubtedly.
You know, there was talk also, Casey, I think I read somewhere that she had told her corner that she'd torn her MCL, hurt her knee in that first round, they didn't see that they didn't see that as any reason to stop the fight either, you know. So
yeah,
you know, they wanted to fight, obviously, at that point. You know, that's pretty extreme for sure. I read somewhere also that like the Brazilian Athletic Commission, they blamed Yamasaki and said that even though they approved the match, like if the official sees that it's a mismatch at any point, he's to stop it. So like, what would have happened if they just said go and he immediately just steps in and is like, this is not good. This fight is not.
I don't like the look. Yeah,
this is not good.
You know how they honor those rules in Brazil.
Right.
Could you imagine if just somebody kind of didn't like the way that the flow of the fight was going and they were just like, no, done. Well, guys, that was a great discussion. We were able to touch on two, you know, big topics. I want to thank particularly Justin Brown, of course, our whole panel, but Justin Brown for coming on and being on the hot seat there for UMAF. Of course, we had a lot of positive things to say, but, you know, you also fielded a lot of concerns as well, and we appreciate that. And we're so happy to have UMAF involved in Valor Fights and events across the world, the United States and the world. And we look forward to big things out of that. With that being said, that does it for our Valor Hour main event, as well as another episode of the Valor Hour. Remember to subscribe on Apple Podcasts as well as Stitcher, and please share this broadcast. We return right here next week as we continue our discussion on the biggest combat sports news from across the globe. A huge thanks to our great lineup of guests this week, as well as a huge shout out to Ogle, Elrod, and Beryl for their tremendous support. For myself, Casey Oxendine, and Valor Fights President Tim Loy, this has been the Valor Hour.
For more information on upcoming events, visit ValorFights.com or find them at Valor Fights on both Facebook and Twitter. This has been the Valor Hour, powered by the law offices of Ogle, Elrod, and Beryl on Radio Influence.
The mainstream media and certain activist groups would have you believe that all white police officers are racist thugs. But what if I told you this was the furthest thing from the truth? What if I told you crime brings police, not color? What if I told you a 30-second video does not tell a complete story of what really happened? If you really want to hear a logical explanation of policing in this country, then listen to me, Vincent Hill, Tuesdays on Beyond the Badge. Beyond the Badge can be found on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and RadioInfluence.com.